Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Here I am in London's Queen's Park, very fashionable with the, we've just moved out in Notting Hill Gate because we're going to have children set. And I'm here to meet the Queen of Food, Henrietta Green. Henrietta brought US-style farmers markets to Britain. She started Borough Food Market and has written countless recipe books and books about food, including The Food Lover's Guide to Britain. Henrietta champions British food and suppliers and has recently started pop-up feasts. Nigella Lawson says that Henrietta is the best food finder in Britain. Henrietta Green, welcome to Gorgeous Lives.
Thank you.
So food is a passion for you. How did it start?
Oh, way back when I was a child. I mean, I have really, really early food memories. In fact, one of my earliest stories was sitting in the nursery. And I had a very conventional upbringing in one sense and never ate with the parents. We ate in the nursery, we being my sisters and I, with our nanny, and my parents ate downstairs in the dining room. And one Sunday, and I must have been maybe three at the time, there was this sort of huge furore, and I remember, and what I remember most about it was that there was a gorgeous, white, beautifully crispy-skinned, fat chicken arrived. And consternation, lots of shouting, screaming, because my parents got what we were meant to have, which was beef. And of course, ironically, in those days, chicken was much more of a luxury than beef. Well, we got to eat this wonderful chicken and my parents got to eat the beef. Not a hardship, but I can remember the taste, I can remember the flavour, and I do have some really very early memories.
So food, you're excited by food even when you were young?
Even when I was young, I loved food. I loved eating, I loved the textures, I loved the smells. And I remember sort of my childhood was punctuated by certain food memories and certain dishes. And Mrs. Alexander, the cook, when I was ill, always used to make scrambled eggs with tomatoes. Now, I don't know whether you've ever made scrambled eggs with tomatoes, but if you cut the tomatoes in it, the eggs go all runny and sort of claggy, and the tomatoes sort of get slightly overcooked. But, you know, I still love it. I mean, that is my ultimate comfort food. On toast and put it on in enough time, because she had to carry it right the way down, right up into the top floor where we slept, so the toast would go all soggy. That's what I want when I'm ill.
So it sounds like you had a cook. You were born in London in St John's Wood. Were you middle class, upper middle class? Were your parents wealthy?
Well, class, of course, is one thing and wealth is another. And my father was first generation Russian immigrant. His parents came over.
Was he Jewish?
He was Jewish. Yeah. His parents came over to escape the pogrom and settled in the East End. And he was the eldest boy, had three older sisters, and then there were 10 altogether. So wow. You work out the maths. Wow. My mother was altogether a different kettle of fish. Much more money, much sort of inherited money, mm-hmm. and sort of grander, although slight sort of curious antecedents going on there. But by the time I was born, my father had made quite a lot of money, which he lost just before he died. And so although we weren't grand in the social sense, we lived very high on the hog. You know, there were servants, there were nannies, there were cleaners, there were drivers, lived in a very big house. There was quite a lot of money sloshing around.
So it was post-war, even though, I mean, you are, you know, you're not that old, but you know what I mean? You're probably, you remember when food wasn't that good in Britain. So do you remember, like, food arriving, food developing over the years in your childhood?
I remember huge differences, and I mean, certainly now, between what we eat and think of now and what I had as a child. And, I mean, in a funny sort of way, there's a kind of a bit of a reversal, not to the restrictiveness of what there was as a child, but to the way of cooking and eating. So, you know, it was the joint of beef on the Sunday lunch, and then there would be different ways of using it and sort of stews.
My mum had like a mincer and she'd mince it up and make shepherd's pie on the Monday.
And sort of, it was quite traditional, quite basic. When I was a little older, we stopped having nannies and had au pairs. And one of our au pairs, Irma, was a wonderful cook. And I remember her making gnocchi.
Oh,
those pillows of perfection, little plumpy potato bit. Oh, God, they were good. And so I got intrigued. I went away for the first time abroad to Italy and then to France very quickly afterwards. And it was then that I became aware of how food could taste of the sunshine. You could get the richness, you could get the warmth. And I remember my parents rented a villa and going with Caroline, the cook, to market and the smells and the sights and going in from the dark, or going into the dark from the sunshine. And then as your eyes became accustomed, seeing the fishes and the vegetables and the salads and the smell of ripe tomatoes. And in fact, one of the very, very first things I ever cooked, because we had our cook and she didn't allow us into the kitchen, was a tomato sauce. And purely instinctively, I realised that we got the tomatoes and these were pretty sort of watery tomatoes, yes. Not much flavour, not much anything. And I put sugar in just out of instinct because I wanted that sweetness. I wanted that sun. And I knew that you had to boil it to get rid of the water. I just kind of knew these things. Goodness knows why.
How old were you then?
I was about 7 or 8. And I just was let loose in the kitchen and just did it because that's what I wanted. And it was purely instinctive. And I remember the tastes and I just wanted to recreate them.
Fabulous, fabulous. So you've been interested in food all your life. You've also, I should have mentioned in the introduction that you also do cook, but we'll go on to that later. You went to school quite near where you lived. It's called Queen's College. It's still around. It's in Harley Street. It has some very famous alumni, including Anna Wintour, Unity Mitford, Jacqueline Dupre and Peaches Geldof.
Not all there at the same time as I was. Yeah. Of the list, Jacqueline Dupre, I think, was there. I sort of have a vague memory of somebody sort of wafting in. Jane Asher was there, actually, as well. And Anna Wintour was there when I was there. And I had an older sister who was quite sort of chic. And she had bought this block mascara called Long Cil Bonxa. And it was black block mascara, and you used to have to sort of spit on the brush and go... And you get your eyelashes. And if you did it just at the right density, it would go really, really long. Your eyelashes could spread like that. And I used to give eyelash mascara putting on sessions downstairs. And Anna was one of my pupils, although I don't think she, A, would remember it, or B, acknowledge it, or C, even know who I was. But that was one of my first claims to cool fashion.
Yeah, I love it. You said to me earlier that school wasn't a very inspiring place. I mean, it is now, obviously, because schools are good now, but it wasn't very good.
Not when I was. I mean, we were hopelessly undereducated.
Yeah.
And I don't think much attempt was made to engage us. I did have a very, very good English teacher who really was good. And
that's the most important subject, really, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I'm talking English literature rather than... And so she did enlighten me a quest for reading and a joy for character, which was very good. Yeah. But apart from that... And actually, I have a very good natural ability for languages. And in a way, it's kind of a shame that this wasn't
discovered
or whatever. Mm. You know, I can go away and after a few days... I can very often pretend and certainly sound that I'm speaking the language, but can pick it up very... I mean, I spent 18 months in India and when I came back could speak Hindi without ever having had a lesson. I could speak it reasonably sort of conversationally. Can't remember a word now, but I have that aptitude and I've got the ear. Yeah.
Fabulous, fabulous. Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous. So did you have any idea what you wanted to do? Because you did go on to RADA.
Well, at the time, I thought that's what I wanted to do. But
was that to be an actress?
No, not really. I'm not actually altogether sure why I went to RADA, looking back on it. But at the time, I thought I did. And I did. I got in and I went. No, it wasn't. It was to in production and stage management, which actually, funny enough, was a wonderful, wonderful discipline. And it has sort of enabled me to... It's taught me a lot of things about applying to tasks, about seeing them through, about reliability, about punctuality. I say that with a certain degree of irony. But it's kind of been a very, very good training.
So it's like learning to be a producer, and everyone has, what you think about all business is about producing something.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I mean, what it didn't necessarily teach you, and I wish it had, was how to manage budgets. And but I mean, that was one of the things that I now find so terribly frustrating about the education that one had. I mean, I remember I wanted to create quite recently, I was trying to sort of create a table and a particular shape, and I knew in the sort of recesses of my mind that there was an algebraic equation that would have actually given me the ability to have created it. But you know, people, you learnt all this stuff in abstract, and nobody ever really talked to you about any kind of practical application. You just think, what a waste. And, you know, the kind of mind that you may or may not have wasn't channeled in any particularly useful way.
Yeah.
It was just, you know...
Learning by rote and that's it, sort of thing, isn't it?
Just a waste, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I can see, but that was probably... I'd probably women in education been like that, you know, for a long time, really.
Well, part of my problem, so my parents said, but I never thought it was a problem, is that I would never accept anything. So if somebody said, this is this, and I'd say, but why? You know, and I wanted to know. And I did...
That's a sign of intelligence, isn't it?
Well, I don't know.
Inquiring mind. Yeah.
Far bit from me to say so. But
Or a stroppy teenager.
Well, no, this was pre-teens. Yeah. But this used to get up everybody's nose and they just thought I was being difficult or whatever. So, you know, there it is.
So were you a rebel?
Yes, but probably not by many other people's standards, in the sense that because I had a really restrictive and unnecessarily restrictive childhood, and my parents, my mother primarily, she did everything by numbers. So I'm the youngest of three. And when my elder sister, she was, say, 10, she could stop wearing short white socks and go into long socks. And when she was 12, she could start wearing stockings or something. And, you know, in those days, although things certainly didn't move as fast as they do now, you know, by the time I was 12, all my friends, and also I was the youngest in my class. And, you know, and I just felt very, very held back, and I couldn't see the point of it. I mean, why were we doing like this? And my mother was very, you know, she wanted things done the way that she wanted them, and there was no brooking, there was no possibility of change or flexibility, whatever. So, yes, I did rebel. And
what, did you secretly go and get changed and do things like behind it?
No, it was much more fundamental than that, actually. I mean, I think I was quite subversive. I would question. I refused to mix with the people whom they wanted me to mix with. I developed a very secret life, really, an inner secret life. And the day I could leave home, I left home. I ran away from home a couple of times, but it was marginally ineffective in that they were never around when I was away from home, so they never really knew, you know. But literally, the day I was 21, because in those days you had to be 21, I left home.
And
I remember a friend of mine who came to move me, and we were getting my stuff up and down the stairs, and he would be singing, "She's leaving home." Bye-bye, the Beatles' favourite. And my parents were sort of locked up in the study. And I didn't think they even came out and said goodbye. Oh. And I went off, you know, and it was such relief. God, it was good. I could do what I wanted. I could stay out late if I wanted. You know, I didn't have to be home at 11 o'clock. And it was absolutely ludicrous because I was working by this time. I'd been, you know, living a full life. I had full responsibilities. And they still wanted to treat me like a child. So, yeah, there you go.
So you had a difficult relationship with your mother. Did you get on well with your father?
Not particularly, no. No, yeah. Sad, but there you go. And, you know, neither, as you say, with my mother. And the best conversation I've ever had with my mother was the day she died, actually. And I sat with her after she died, and her presence was still in the room. And I realised then that she had probably done the best that she was capable of, but it was woefully inadequate. And this, I might tell you, was after a fair degree of help, sort of analysis, etc., to have got to that stage. But it was not a very happy childhood. And, I mean, my sadness is much more for the fact that I don't really miss my parents, you know. I don't feel that I had that close relationship. But I think one has to accept responsibility. So you don't go around, or I don't go around, blaming them. I am what I am. And, you know, I have to go forward and loosen the shackles. Otherwise, it just will repeat from generation to generation.
Exactly, exactly. Sounds like you've been in the therapy long enough now.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying all the right things. So you went to RADA and you left, but you said you learnt lots of good life skills there. But in 1974, you joined forces of Antonia Graham and became the other half of All Things Fabulous of a Home in Notting Hill, Graham and Green, which is still going.
It is still going, but in fact, neither Antonia nor I have anything to do with it. Oh. It's run by Antonia's son, Jamie.
Okay.
And thank you. I mean, it was extraordinary. Antonia had had experience of running a shop. I had had absolutely none. And I remember the day we opened. It was so funny. We got the lease and we bought the stock and did it all up within 2 weeks on the teeniest, weeniest budget imaginable. Because Antonia had gone tits up with another, with her original shop, we couldn't get any credit. So we had quite a lot of stuff on sale or return. And we'd kept a little bit aside so that we could pay our expenses and wages over the next few months. And on the Friday, which was Good Friday, some friends and Antonia and I spent the day in the shop putting the stuff up on the shelves. And there was sort of like, you know, we had three jugs. So we had to push them forward, and like everybody would think that there was a whole pile of jugs behind. You know. And we cleaned the windows so people could see through, left the lights on, which we thought was quite a daring thing to do, and went home. And as we were going home, it's about 11 o'clock, we turned to each other and said, "Let's have a little lie-in." The following morning.
This was Elgin Crescent.
This was in Elgin
so
Crescent.
It's still there, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not actually. It's on the other side of the road okay. from the original shop.
But still, it's still the same road.
So he said, "Well, let's have a little lie-in and we'll get there." We'll get there at 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
Open the shop then.
Perfect for Notting Hill.
Perfect for Notting Hill. We have time to put on, wash our hair, put our makeup on, turn up. Turned up at 11 o'clock. There was a queue snaking round the pavement. And I remember on day one, so we had invested in total £2,000.
Gosh, that was a lot then.
And it was a lot then. Mm. And on our first day, we took something like £372 and had to go out shopping the following week to get more stuff. It was amazing. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary.
So were there no kind of homeware shops selling extraordinary things then?
Well, Habitat, of course, did exist, but certainly not.
That was more basic, though, wasn't it, than you? You were more original things.
General Trading Company. There were a couple, but, I mean, we certainly not where we were, and certainly not I would like to say with our, forgive me if I say so myself, yeah, style, flair, elan, yeah, taste. So, I mean, you know.
So what was in the original Graham and Greene then?
Well, in the original Graham and Greene, there was some kitchenware, basketware. We started having stuff made for us very soon. We mixed old and new, which was very original and unheard of. One of the things that we did stock was Seconds China, the white octagonal china and this navy china called calico, which had sort of flowers on it. And what we hadn't realised was that there'd been a barrow in the Portobello Road, in the market, that had sold this china, but they disappeared about 6 months prior to us opening. So lucky for us, a lot of people, because in those days, of course, Notting Hill Gate was not the repository of rich bankers, but was sort of people who hadn't been able to.
Interesting people
like us who couldn't sort of afford to live in the posher areas. So they all had these Seconds China and they fell upon us. And word went around like wildfire that we had this china. So we built up our customer base very, very quickly.
Radio Gorgeous makes one feel like $1 million.
Yeah. And actually, rather interesting story was, as the youngest of three girls, you always assume that your older sisters, because they are older, and older should mean wiser, should mean that they know what they're talking about. And I remember telling my sister that we were going to open a shop in Elgin Crescent, just off the Portobello Road, and she rang me up and said, "You can't do that." So I said, "Well, why not?" She said, "It's the most terrible place. It's the most terrible place. I've been sitting outside the shop and nobody's gone by." And I said, "Well, when did you do that?" And she said, "Well, I've just been doing it this afternoon." And I said, "Well, what day is it?" She said, "Well, it's Thursday." And I said, "Yes, and didn't you bother to find out that the market shuts on Thursday afternoon? So of course it's going to be quiet and everything." And it was then that I realised that they don't always know what they're talking about.
That was a breakthrough.
It was a serious breakthrough.
I just want to ask what Notting Hill was like in the early 70s, because obviously listeners might, you know, might not know.
Well, in the early 70s, Notting Hill Gate and the Portobello Road were huge fun, great mixture of people, very run down. I mean, not quite as run down as they had been, full of rather colourful people, full of druggies. You had to pick your way over needles and piles of people to get into the shop if you arrived early. I mean, very traditional shops. They've all disappeared now. I mean, Mr. Harper was the electrician where you could take your toaster, which failed for the eighth time, he would still mend it. And then, you know, and then Tom came along, and now it's Harper and Tom's trendy flowers, but not even there, you know. Yeah. So it was so different. The laundrettes were there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, one of the highlights, which I think came a few years, I can't remember how many years after we'd opened, was 192, which was such an exciting restaurant with Alistair Little cooking there. And you could go and eat one of his seasonal salads. And a big bowl was about £3. And they were never the same. And they were always a great lunch, very filling. And it was hugely exciting. There were all kinds of sort of scummy people and interesting people. David Hockney, his boyfriend used to come and shop with us. I mean, all, you know, designers, actors. And in fact, actually, we used to employ out of work actors as shop assistants, because as Anthony said, you get a nice class of person when they're well trained to be polite. And some of them went on to be great stars. And
they'd
say, don't, because they're dead now. So yeah.
Oh.
And it was great fun.
Yeah.
And you know, there was a lot of music, there was a lot of, but it was also, there was a sort of an underbelly about it. And it was the days of the riots with the carnival. And you used to have to board up the shop because you were frightened that it would get broken and you'd feel guilty about that. But, you know, there was a lot of shoplifting. There was a lot of thieving.
Wow.
So it was quite tough as well. But then you'd get frightfully grand people, because we got a lot of publicity. We were in the very smart magazines, the Vogues, Harper's and Queen, etc., etc. And we'd get very smart people coming in with that. I do remember every Christmas you used to get this glutch of countesses. And they'd drive up from Eaton Square. And of course, in those days, the extraordinary thing was that people wrote checks and you'd ask for their addresses so you knew where they lived. Yeah. And it was different in those days. Yeah. And there is a huge sadness, but everything moves on.
Yeah, I think it's all moved east, hasn't it? In South London as well.
Or I would hope to say Northwest, which is where I now live.
Yeah. Well, I think that's gentrified now, totally. So now your first music choice on Gorgeous Lives, If I Were a Carpenter by Tim Harden. So why did you choose that one, Henrietta?
Because I have really great memories of it. One summer, my parents were away, and I was sort of in the house alone, although I can't have been, because they would never have left me alone, but I can't remember anybody being there.
Just you're in your room, so you felt alone.
No, because I certainly was not in my room. And the reason why I remember this so well was by this time we'd had an addition to the house, which was a sun lounge. And it was a sort of wonderful room with a sort of marble banquette running round it. And we had a rather posh record player. And I got the Tim Harden LP. And one summer's night, I had a supper party for about 12, 14 of us sitting at the dining room with all the family silver.
Yeah.
And I did. And I can remember what I cooked for the first course.
Oh, yeah, tell us.
I can't remember the rest. So that was pretty interesting.
What did you cook? Come on.
It was an avocado and crab salad.
Wow, that's really advanced for
it
then.
Was wasn't terribly
it?
Advanced.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I knew that the flavour of the avocado would go really well with the flavour of the crab. And it did. And I can remember that. I can't remember anything else that I served.
I suppose it
there.
Was the excitement of that putting those two tastes together that you remember more than anything. With If I Was a Carpenter in the background.
I Was a Carpenter in the background. Tim Harden in the background.
If I were a carpenter, you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby? If a tinker were my trade, would you still find me carrying the pots I made, following behind me? Save my love for sorrow, save my love for lonely. I've given you my tomorrow, love me only. If I work my hands in wood, would you still love me? Tim, I could, how could you above me? If I were a miller at a mill wheel grinding, would you miss your coloured blocks?
Now, because we're running short of time, we've got to fast forward now to your food career. You didn't stay at Graham and Green. You sold out your share after 10 years. Then you became a producer, is that right, for TV?
No, that was before.
Okay.
It was all before I went.
Okay, but then you moved to the country and you started writing about food.
Yes.
That's what happened. And you were growing and cooking. And tell us about how, because you didn't know you were going to be a writer. How did what brought upon the idea to write a cookbook?
When I left and went travelling, I thought I was going to write, and I did the research for book.
Left
and I
what?
Never...
Left you left?
When I left work,
yeah.
My production work,
yeah.
And then went abroad, and I thought I was going to do research and write a book, and I never did. So by that time, I'm pretty sure that I wanted to write, and I coupled that with some research. And as a researcher, I mean, whoever would... And I started writing, and I loved it. And I was cooking and writing, but it was only after a while that I really think I discovered my true, quote, métier as a writer. So what happened was that I moved to the country and I started writing, I suppose really seriously, about food. I was growing a lot of vegetables. And in fact, if you ask various friends, the first time most of them had ever tried rocket, because I bought seeds back from Italy. And I was always very inquiring, very interested, trying to get a sense of stuff that you'd had abroad that you thought was good and why you couldn't get it here, but also looking for what here, what Britain, what the UK was good at, what it was proud of, and why these kind of traditions weren't being preserved. I was writing recipes, cooking, enjoying food. And then I had sort of, if you like, a bit of a sort of a Damascene conversion. And I started really writing about ingredients, about trying to discover what it was that made them good, that made them special. And in those days, people didn't write about food. You were a cookery writer, that was it. And I managed to persuade The Independent to allow me to write a column about unusual things, why rare breed meats, for example, would have a different taste, what it was about making a cheese, a cheddar, a really good one, tastes different, you know, what were the stages. And I was terribly curious about quality, food quality in its truest and widest sense. And I always remember Mr. Lydgate, David Lydgate the butcher, saying in terms of meat, and it's true of any aspect of food, any ingredient, that quality is a chain. And there are so many different links that go about making that ingredient what it is. And but each link of that chain has to be in place in order to ensure quality. So I started collecting, I started visiting producers, I started trying to make my own cheese or whatever, but I mean in a rather sort of haphazard way. And slowly the collection emerged for what was first British Food Finds, which was a directory of British ingredients but for the trade, and then the consumer book, which is really what brought the whole thing into notice, which was The Food Lover's Guide to Britain.
And that really took off.
That really did take off, and that made a huge difference. And from that, I'd already been to the States and come across the farmers' markets there, or the green markets, and was campaigning to get them going here. And then,
what year was that?
Well, I had gone sort of in the 80s, and it had taken quite a while to get people to sort of, like, listen. And then in the mid-90s, I had the first ever food market in the sense of the word. I mean, of course, there were markets and everything, but this was a quality market in St. Christopher's Place. And that was for the publication of the second version of The Food Lover's Guide. And
so you had independent producers there.
Yes.
You had all different.
We had sort of my top 20 and a few others.
And how did it go?
It was huge success. I mean, like anything, it was difficult getting the publicity. Yeah. You know, we did everything on a very small budget. And then as a result of that, one of the traders was Randolph Hodgson of Neil's Yard Dairy. Mm. And he said to me, well, he was moving out from Neil's Yard. And he was going to, he'd bought a place to mature his cheeses in a place called Barrow Market. And would I be interested in launching a market there? Now, Barrow Market, of course, existed, but as a wholesale market. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, I think it was 2 or 3 years later, we launched Barrow Market. And that was phenomenal. By this time, again, the appetite was growing. There was a hunger which had developed. And people just came. And I remember we had 50 producers in the sort of the main hall, which was dank and dirty and dripping water. And it was sort of the market, and they, the people at Barrow, had wanted us to open it for the 3 days, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And on the Friday morning, and it was just before 9 o'clock when we were due to open, and I looked around with absolute abject horror. And I thought, oh my God, what have I done? You know, what on earth was I thinking about?
Mm.
And I can remember that sinking feeling.
Who's
going to come to this? I'm going to be lynched by all these producers. Yeah. And quite a lot of them had sold out by 12 o'clock. We were mobbed. We were absolutely mobbed. And it was a huge success. And I had great support from a couple of sort of real stalwarts. Clarissa, who by at that time was sort of at the height of her fame.
That's Clarissa Dixon Wright, Two Fat Ladies.
Two Fat Ladies. Yeah. So Clarissa and Jennifer came down and we put on a stint of Jennifer with her long red, very tapered fingernails. It's going, pulling at the tits and milking a goat.
I can just imagine her loving it.
And it was great. And we had huge success.
That really was. I remember that exact time, which would have been about 10, 15 years ago, when it really food was starting to get exciting, wasn't it?
Mm. And it's slightly sad how it hasn't... Well, I don't think it can remain exciting, but how it hasn't sort of intensified its integrity and how it's become a fashion and yes. It's become a fad. Mm. And, I mean, I used to think, well, what does it matter as long as it's being talked about? Mm. It, you know, it's better than what it was before that. And I now slightly wonder whether I was right in thinking that. I now think, well, I'm not so sure. You know,
because people now, it's like supermarkets like to have the image of it because they know it attracts people in, but that's all they're doing. They're using it for marketing, aren't they?
Yes, but on the other hand, I'm not altogether sure necessarily that you can justify sometimes the huge difference in prices for products, produce, ingredients.
Well,
that
just
you
to
buy.
Say that I go to a farmer's market around here in Chiswick and it is expensive, but we go there because we want really good meat, we want really good vegetables. But then I went this weekend to Bedford because I had to go to a romance festival for Radio Gorgeous. I went to their market, which was a normal market, had a brilliant butcher with pheasants, wild duck, really cheap, £2.50 each, had bowls of coxes, bowls of unusual apples, £1.20 each. And I just said, why are you so cheap? I said, because we're not London, love, and we're not a farmer's market. Mm. And I thought, why can't all markets, the quality there was fantastic. There was even Italian food stalls selling sourdough, massive loaf for £2.20.
Well, my very point. And I do somehow, I do worry now as well, in the sense that I think farmer's markets, if you look at the ideals for the American markets, the green markets, what they were trying to do, how they were trying to achieve, and how they were trying to support the communities, etc. How here they've just been sort of enclaves for yummy mummies.
And then we are the only people that can afford it.
No, well, that's part of the point. And I think there is a lot that could be done to make it different.
Now your next music choice is Cleopatra's Aria from Haydn's Julius Caesar. With your bob dark hair and passions for life, can you relate to Cleopatra, who was a fighter like you?
I suppose I never really thought of it in those terms. Possibly, yes. I mean, I studied Antony and Cleopatra, the Shakespeare version, for my, was it O-level or A-level? I can't actually remember. And I remember being mesmerised by her. But the reason actually why I chose that was that I saw a production of Julius Caesar at Glyndebourne. And it was mesmerising. And when Cleopatra breaks into this aria about having been rather mean and vile to Caesar, and then suddenly she sees the point of him and she's completely fallen in love with him. And it was just such a perfect moment in opera when I realised the whole point and the essence of it. And it was a thing of such beauty that it stayed with me forever. And it's rare to have that complete a moment, or I find it's rare. And so that's really why I chose it. I mean, you could argue the picnic that we'd had beforehand had been particularly good. And another crab moment, as it so happens. It was a crab and saffron tart, which unfortunately one of my great friends sat in. So she had a black dress with an orange bottom and smelt rather horrid as well. But it was just so beguiling.
Sleep ye, O, sleep ye, O,
there are 750 food markets in the UK. So are you pleased about that?
Yes. I mean, you've got to be. It's a lot more than there used to be. Mm. But there is a possible argument that although quantity is very good, I think one has to be a little wary of the quality and the range and the choice. I mean, if you live in France, still, even though a lot has happened that's not been purely for the good food-wise within France and otherwise, actually, at least you can virtually anywhere go probably no more than about 15 miles and have a market virtually every day to shop from. And still the towns and the villages have the food shops. And I would like to see that happen much more here, so that was more regularity of purchase. But then, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be only a farmer's market if the quality is there.
Yeah, exactly.
And my argument would be also that the quality isn't necessarily there from the farmer's market anyhow.
Okay, now, what do you feel? I mean, I've literally, in the last month in this area, seen two Sainsbury's opening. I mean, you know, just they're just... Now Sainsbury's and everyone, you know, Tesco, they're all doing these mini supermarkets. I mean, they are taking over the corner shop now. I mean, they are monopolising us even more.
Well, I am always rather wary of monopolies. Mm. So I can't say that I'm terribly pleased about it. Mm. On the other hand, at the bottom of my road is a local Sainsbury's. And I go there if I haven't done a shop.
Yeah, of course, we all do.
And I never used to, and I do now. I berate the narrowness of its choice. Yeah, I'm pretty sort of bored with it. But I still do go. I think we have some very, very curious planning laws, which has allowed this kind of development. I think the Monopolies Commission and the trading offices thereof are very curious. I mean, there's huge brouhaha at the moment about the fact that there are only six major energy suppliers and that they're looking about whether they have a sort of a secret price pledge, etc., etc. And, you know, well, why aren't people really doing that with the supermarkets? There are only not even six major brands. I think there are some not particularly necessary, very healthy practices going on. And I think our food suffers from it hugely. But people don't necessarily support their local shops. And when you look at some of the local shops, you're not necessarily very surprised why people don't support them.
I tell you what's changed, what you've obviously made things change in supermarkets, Henrietta, is that, you know, you do when you buy strawberries, you can see, oh, these were born in Kent in the name of the grower. I mean, that has come in because of your passion for food and supporting the growers.
Well, yes, I'm not sure that it's necessarily thanks to me. I mean, in fact, I did work as a consultant to Waitrose for several years. And I would like to think that I did have some influence on their food policy. But again, people think by knowing the variety, this is a hugely good thing. But sometimes the variety is meaningless because it's a modern sort of hybrid that's been developed. I mean, what it does mean that if you had a punnet of Tom Tom strawberries and like them, you might look for them again. But I sometimes think there's a kind of a bit of, I mean, knowing the variety doesn't necessarily make it a better bit of product, just that, because as I said, quality is a chain and every link needs to be in place. So, you know.
Yeah.
But our knowledge, I mean, to me, the nearer you can buy it to its point of production, the better. As you just said, shop in a local market wherever you are. You know, not talking farmers markets, but just local. It, you know, you can see there the food should be, but isn't necessarily always fresher, better, and at a better price. But sometimes, you know, when I come travelling around and I'll pick up stuff, and I mean, I rarely buy meat in London. I usually buy it when I'm out and about. I mean, this tomorrow I'm going down to Dorset for a meeting, and I'll probably pop into a really good game merchant that I know and buy some game on the way back. It'll be well hung, well plucked, you know, and I'll put it in the freezer on a couple of really good cheap cuts, good for braising. And so I tend to shop. But then when you come to London and you look, see, the prices are extraordinarily high.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Now tell us about your pop-up feasts you've just started. What's
well,
this?
I've started doing pop-up feasts. I mean, partly because I love cooking, and at my great age, I suddenly thought, well, perhaps I should do more cooking and cook for more people. And what I've decided to do, which is, I would like to say unique, but I'm not totally sure, but it's quite rare, is that I want to hero producers, British producers, so that people get the opportunity to try the food and cook it in whatever way I want. I mean, obviously, to enhance it. Well, for example, one of the starters that I'm doing at the moment. So what vegetables are in season? All the different pumpkins. Mm-hmm. So roast those and cook some lentils, that sort of dark green, which look very attractive with the oranges, and roast them, and then roast a couple of onions, and then serve them with nicely and lightly dressed, but with a dollop of a really delicious, I shouldn't use that word, but I mean, just deep, very velvety, very good, mild but creamy goat's milk curd cheese to go with it. Mm. And that's made in Somerset by a wonderful cheese producer. So it's an opportunity to try that cheese. And then,
will you have a producer there or not?
Not really, because it's quite a small... I mean, I'd like to, depending where I have them and depending what I do. I mean, I have said that I will cook in people's homes, or I'm also looking to do it in a sort of larger place where you can have the producers have more numbers.
Yeah, like a church hall or something.
Yes, but then on the other hand, my cooking skills are perhaps a little limited. So I'm not sure that I can cope with huge numbers. I would need help. But another of my favourite producers is their farmers down in Devon called Piper's Farm. And they do these wonderful, wonderful, really big, fat chickens. So actually I've called it a fat hen, but it's really a fat cock. And so I cook it in a rather unusual way, which is a great French recipe. And you make a very rich chicken liver and bacon stuffing. And you stuff the bird, and then you poach it in water with various vegetables, ironically charred, but also sort of carrots and onions and celery. And you just poach it very gently. And so for the first course, you serve the liquor in which it's been poached with some very light little dumplings.
So it's like a kind of consomme.
Yes, it's just, you know, but you wouldn't bother to clarify it or anything. You just have it with, and with the few vegetables and some little sort of, as I say, light dumplings. And then the main course, you have the chicken with the stuffing. The rest of the vegetables, the charred thing, and you make what is a sauce sauge. And it's a wonderful sauce that is with eggs that you poach very lightly in some of the consommé, and then you chop up with capers and parsley and olive oil, and then you add olive oil. And the richness of it with the stuffing and the really well-flavoured chicken, that sort of light meatiness to it. It is a stunning dish. And but it only works if you have got a really good quality densely textured, so has to have been free-ranged, has to have matured, so it's not flabby, and also would give and yield flavour into the poaching stock, but without becoming insipid and vapid in itself.
You're making me really hungry.
Well, that is the point of it.
Now, tell me, what's your website address if people want to get in contact with you?
www.henriettagreen.co.uk. And for anybody who doesn't know, Henrietta is spelled H-E-N-R-I-E-T-T-A.
Okay, so it's been fabulous talking today, but I just want to talk about your last music choice. It's Mr. Bojangles by Nina Simone. Why did you choose this one?
Because every time I hear it, and it's quite dangerous if I'm listening to it while I'm driving, I just want to get up and dance.
Oh.
And it's that wonderful, wonderful voice of Nina Simone, and that depth and that experience that comes through, the pain, the suffering. Mm. And there's a moment in the song when it misses a beat, and you just go, life's like that.
Henrietta Green, thank you so much for being on Gorgeous Lives.
Thank you.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. Worn out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt and baggy pants. The old soft shoe. Jumped so high, jumped so high. Then he lightly touched the ground. I met him in a cell in New Orleans. I was down. Looked at me to be the eyes of age. As he spoke right out, he talked of life, talked of life. He laughed and slapped his leg a step.
Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.